and welcome to the third episode of Owen's Variety Hour, or Owen's Variety Show. Honestly, I don't even remember the name of the show anymore. In one place, it's one thing. In another place, it's a different thing. So it's not really sure which one's official or which one I even prefer. Maybe it can be a sort of a hybrid name, Owen's Variety Show Hour or Hour Show, unless my show is ever a different length than an hour. Hopefully, preferably shorter. I doubt that anyone wants more of this realistically. But to any first-time listeners out there, my name's Owen, and this is my hour-long variety show. Maybe that's what it'll be, Owen's hour-long variety show. It just rolls off the tongue. But anyways, I'm thinking that I should probably get some sort of an intro tagline, maybe make it a little bit more interesting, a little professional. I think that could be fun. I have my fun one at the end, the residence one, and if anyone hasn't heard the show before, oh boy, get excited, because it's pretty great. You'll be left on quite the note, if I say so myself. And you know what? In my constant efforts to make this show a bit more exciting, I think that I might start adding some more segments, and this is an idea I sort of played with last week, and I sort of brought some of my signature sports commentary that people in my day-to-day life know and love. And I'm thinking of maybe doing this column. It's called Sports Zone. Sports with a Z and Zone with a Z, so they combine into the Sports Zone. And you know what? You don't gotta be a genius to know that this was a pretty important weekend for sports. And the Super Bowl, yeah, it was pretty exciting. But I gotta say, not too much happened, but my tummy, yeah, it hurt a bit. I'd say the highlights of the whole night would be the meatballs, maybe some of the nachos. The lowlights, I'd say, were the football parts and the Maroon 5s. The Travis Scott's, too. Not too great. What's Outkast without Andre 3000, am I right, guys? And you know what? That's the Sports Zone. I think it's a pretty good column. I think I'm going to continue it into the future. And to continue, I'm not going to try and showcase or advertise for the Princess Cinema in Waterloo too much, because I'm pretty sure that I signed a contract saying that I won't do that, at least for money. But I'm not being paid money yet, so if I will be open for advertisements, but just don't tell Radio Laurier. But anyway, so I'll be going there tonight to see the 2001 comedy-of-age comedy classic Ghost World. It has Thora Birch in it, who's the daughter from American Beauty. Eek! But it also has a young Scarlett Johansson and Steve Buscemi. And I don't really know too much about this movie, but I think I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've been meaning to for a while, and it seems pretty funny. Maybe I'll talk about it next week, but that's just an update on what I've been doing. And just another update, I want to give full disclosure to my audience. I went a bit too long last week. There's a show right after mine called The Crunch, and they were sort of knocking on the door when I was doing the story last week. Not in a mean way or anything. The host was very understanding, but I do feel quite bad about it. So this show might be a little bit shorter than before. Who knows? We'll see. You can give me tips on what to cut out. And don't be mean, please, because my feelings get hurt quite quickly. And, you know, I think there's some fun stuff on the horizon for today's show. We'll be talking about some fun new singles, some movies. There will be an in-depth review of David Lynch's Wild at Heart, and another one of his projects at the same time period. And then we'll jump into a thrilling story about one man's great expedition to climb the mysterious Mount Gronowin. I don't know if you guys know this or anything, but it's a pretty thrilling tale. But before we get into any of that, I'm going to take a quick break. And this first song is Laurie Anderson with Born Never Asked. I'm actually going to restart that. The intro is quite important. Here we go. Thank you. So I apologize if that might have been a bit quiet, I heard from someone who's listening to the show. And I don't know if maybe it was just something with the YouTube video or I don't know, but I really hope that doesn't keep happening into the future because as of what I know, there shouldn't be any issues right now. But we'll see about that. That's a later issue. Who cares if you guys have to sit through 5 minutes of silence every once in a while? It's a good listening exercise. But anyways, now we're going into the new discovery section. And the first thing I'm going to talk about is the new single from Aviterror. Anyone who doesn't know, he is one of the founding members of the psychedelic group Animal Collective. And this is a solo single from him called Saturdays Brackets Again. And this is in support of the upcoming March album entitled Cows on Hourglass Pond. Truly an Animal Collective fashion, naming it with an animal in the name, cows. And so this batch of songs which we'll make of this album is following his album Eucalyptus. And in my opinion, Aviterror hasn't really had a great history with solo albums, particularly some of the more psych pop albums, being Slasher Flicks and Down There. I actually did like his last album, Eucalyptus, because it was sort of more of a folky thing. But this new song, Saturdays, it's very good, actually. It's pretty upbeat. It still has Aviterror's signature sort of hypnotic and psychedelic sounds everywhere. But it's unlike those other albums where it sort of seemed like these psychedelics were either and was misplaced, or he failed to write decent pop songs that would end up being like the bases of these songs. Not that I have anything against pure psychedelic music at all, but in these albums, he still wrote psychedelic stuff around pop songs, and it didn't really work that well. As on Eucalyptus, since I said it's more of a folk album, it ended up being more sort of free folk and loose, which leaned itself more into the psychedelic experimentation than some of the sort of like half-baked pop songs from Slasher Flicks. But I think this song is really well written. It is more of the psych pop songs that I usually don't like from him solo, but it's quite catchy. It stays interesting throughout its runtime, and I'm actually interested in both the instrumentation and the song, if you know what I mean by that. But it's a great song. And this was released alongside a short story thing entitled Thoughts on Hourglass Cows. And the video is sort of just these abstract psychedelic soundscape music things and AV doing spoken word through these dense vocal manipulations. And it's pretty relaxing, to be honest. And it would probably be pretty difficult to understand what he's saying if there wasn't the link to the actual words that he was saying. But so it's pretty much just AV thinking back on old times. Starts with him reminiscing on the start of Animal Collective, learning to record with geologists on an 8-track. And there's other things when he's just talking about nature, music, performing. Nothing too specific. It's just like, yeah, he's just reminiscing on the old times. I doubt I'd read or listen to it again. But it was worth my time, I think. I like Aviterror sort of as a person as well, so it's sort of interesting to see what he has to say. But in other Animal Collective news besides this Aviterror single and announced album, there's actually a Panda Bear solo album coming out on Friday called Buoys, which I haven't actually heard the singles from. I've heard some people really don't like them, but either way, I'm still pretty excited to check it out. And the next thing I want to talk about is the new single from King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. If anyone doesn't know, they're an Australian psych rock band, and the singles are Psy Boogie and Acarine, I think it's pronounced. And these are following the 5 albums that they released last year, which was a mission that they set for themselves at the start of the year. And honestly, most of them ended up being pretty good, particularly the first album, Flying Microtonal Banana, and Polygon Wonderland. And so the first song, Psy Boogie, is sort of just the synthy pop throwback album. It's very fun. It's very sort of outdated, but overall it's just silly. It's fun and cheek, tongue-in-cheek reference to 80s electronic act. It's like a fun craft work, but it goes on for 7 minutes, and it's just this long jam, and it's a pretty great time, I'd say. It's a good song. But the next song is Acarine, and it takes this sort of old school-ish electronic influence, but but then incorporates it a bit more into the psych rock style that people know and like them for. And I have to say that I do like the song more, even though it's the B-side. And I don't think it's, like, officially anywhere. I sort of have, like, this, like, bootleg YouTube thing. But it's really ambitious instrumentally and progressively for the band. It sort of goes into this abstractish house beat thing at the end, and I liked it a lot. But both these songs were released in announcement of a new album this year. I don't know if it has a name or anything, but I think if they can incorporate this style consistently into a full length, it could be killer. It could be great. And then the next thing I want to talk about is the new movie by Hirokazu Koreeda entitled Shoplifters. And this movie actually won the Cannes Palme d'Or Award this most recent year. And I've seen a few other Koreeda movies, particularly his two sort of recent ones, After the Storm and Our Little Sister. And these were both these very emotionally, extremely well-made views of families and the unique dynamics that an individual family can have and that no one can really relate to, and sort of discuss what it really means to be a family. So after seeing these movies and hearing that his new movie is getting a lot of hype, I was incredibly excited for it. And this film sort of continues on those themes. We're seeing the day-to-day life of a family in Japan living in near-to-extreme poverty. And they get by, just like as the title implies, by shoplifting, as well as other sort of scams, as we figure out later. But the family finds a young girl who's sort of been being neglected by her unloving parents. So they decide to take her under her wing, even though her family is more well-off and by the books would give her a better life than this poor family would. They think that it's in the child's best interest at the time to take her and sort of raise her as one of their own, despite all present laws. And I'm not really going to try to spoil anything, but it becomes a really just emotional view of the companionship and love that this family holds, despite anything in their way, sort of. And in particular, there's a scene where one of the main parental figure of the family are telling the girl about how sort of her parents were abusive and didn't really love her. And then they decide to show what love really is, and they give her this nice hug. And you know what? I'm not going to try and act tough. I was crying during this scene. But this movie's really amazing, and it's heartfelt for most of it, and it'll certainly play some tricks on your heart, and it'll leave you with plenty to think about and leave you sort of questioning things as you go out of the theater. And it's a great time. I wouldn't say great time. It's great as in it's high quality, but it's just a really good movie. I feel like it has to take a really good movie to sort of have these complicated reactions coming out of it. But it's new. It's not at the Princess anymore, I don't think, but hopefully it's at some theaters sometime, or you can find it online. I don't want to say too much because I think it just speaks for itself, but it's really something and everyone should check it out. And now I'm going to go into that Aviator song that I mentioned earlier. This is Saturdays Again. Hopefully it's loud enough. I think that song's great. Every time I listen to it, it's like, oh man, this song is great. And you know, that's just the fact that a great track can have on you. Whenever you come out of a song and you're like, man, that was great. Good chance. Great track. So, for my review this week, I figured I'd talk about something from a man that I love, Mr. David Lynch. And so, I've seen all of his movies handful of times, but I haven't seen the movie Wild at Heart from 1990 since high school when I started getting into David Lynch. And so this was his fifth feature film following Blue Velvet, and it was actually made after the pilot of Twin Peaks was made, I believe after most of the first season actually. And I think some of the reason why Lynch didn't really direct most of the second season of Twin Peaks is because he was devoting his time to Wild at Heart. Or maybe it was because of the over-control that the executives were taking over the show at the time. I'm not really sure. I didn't look too far into it, but I saw some, like, differing accounts on Wikipedia of what was happening, so I figured I better just stop before I confuse myself too much. And it's interesting how this ties into Twin Peaks and everything of his work at the time, but I'll get back into that later. So to start, the film stars Laura Dern as Lula, having already been in Lynch's Blue Velvet, but now swaps the dreamy Kyle MacLachlan for the rugged Nick Cage as Sailor. So it's a couple there, Lula and Sailor. So you know it's just going to be one of those movies. And so around now, before I had seen this movie at least, without knowing much about it, you sort of expect Lynch to use Nicolas Cage to his own ways, sort of to fit into his aesthetic, but rather, Nicolas Cage is absolutely crazy in this role. He sort of sets the stage for the Nick Cage that we go on to know and love. Sort of like how he was in the last movie, Mandy. He's just like absolutely wild. There's a lot of yelling. It seems to be improv pretty much. And thinking back to how this fits into the Lynchverse, it's almost like Frank from Blue Velvet sometimes. So the opening scene of this movie sets it up pretty perfectly as Nick Cage just sort of kills some guy on the stairs. He just beats him to death at this fancy function and gets sent right to prison. And this has no context at all, pretty much. We barely know who he is, what his character is, what we're supposed to think about this event. And it almost seems a bit too dumb right when it happens, but it ends up working pretty well with the film in a way I didn't expect. And because as the movie goes on, we sort of slowly learn the motivations behind the whole thing. And there's not a lot of information coming out at the whole time. We don't really get this big picture until all of a sudden Sailor decides to tell Lula his whole secret of how he was the getaway driver and was present for the murder of her father, and it's out of nowhere. And sort of the film is full of these things where it seems like anyone in the writing room should have been like, there has to be a bit more of a maybe nuanced way we could do this, but no, Lynch doesn't care at all. And there isn't really much to say about the plot. It's about Lula and Sailor on the road. They're running from these hitmen and whoever else Lula's mother has sent to kill Sailor because she's so overly protective about her little daughter, even though she's like 23 or something. But throughout in the tradition of the road movie, they run into new people throughout. They exchange stories. And through some of this, Lynch shows how easy it is for him to sort of switch emotions and tones just on a dime. Most notably, there's a story that Lula tells about her crazy uncle, who's portrayed by the weirdo Crispin Glover, most commonly known as Michael J. Fox's father in Back to the Future. And so she starts telling this story. It sort of seems a little quirky. Her uncle thinks he's Santa the whole year round. Haha, how funny. And we just think it's going to be this funny story, but then it ends up not being quirky at all, that she's telling just about some of the things he does, and it turns out he's just really insane. So it goes really quickly to this dark story from this quirky thing, and she keeps talking about him, and by the end, he's not even wearing the Santa costume in the flashbacks. It's like they introduce him this way just to sort of get us tied in and then just play with our emotions to tell this dark insanity story that has affected her life. It's really almost manipulative, and that's what this movie does all the time, that it gives us this impression of being silly and then it just twists it. And some other sort of big plot things that I want to talk about at least are, like, near the end of the movie we meet up with the ultimate skeezball Bobby, who's played excellently by Willem Dafoe, and he's just sort of disgusting. He has these fake dentures in that make his mouth, and he has his mouth wide open like the whole time, and it's really gross and wet, moist the whole time. And it's just as terrifying as it is funny, because he's just absolutely ridiculous. But then you realize that it's only terrifying. And I have to say that it's one of Willem Dafoe's best roles. He really captures the bat crazy aspects of this character, and he loses himself in it. It sort of seems like he's dissociating from his actual self. And with actors that you know really well, sort of like Willem Dafoe, you find that there's sometimes a hard time not seeing them as the person. Like, it's like, oh, Willem Dafoe's doing that. But after a few scenes with this character, it's hard to not only see Bobby. He's just a whole nother thing. And it sounds like I don't want to see Willem Dafoe doing the things that he's doing. because this leads to one of the climaxes of the movie, I'd say, near the end, when there's a really traumatic scene where Bobby nearly almost sexually assaults Lula, but it ends up being this joke that he's doing to her. Like, it's just like he has a punchline lined up, and it's so uncomfortable. And this is just another way that Lynch is playing with us throughout this movie. Because if this joke wasn't precursed by this really dark scene that brings up parts of Lula's past that was shown through flashbacks earlier, it could have been a joke that would have actually maybe raised some laughs. But it's just really hard to in that context, because it almost lightens the situation, but like you're just like, this is crazy. Like, it, I was shocked during the scene the whole time, and then he just like says a joke, and then just like, oh. It's like, it's not funny at all. And it's not supposed to be. It's not like David Lynch missed a joke. He's just sort of playing with us that way. And it's really weird to experience. But after that, I don't want to spoil too much if you haven't seen it. And if you haven't seen it, you don't want spoilers. Maybe just twiddle your thumbs for a minute or so. But Sailor ends up landing back in prison because him and Bobby end up robbing a bank after Bobby killing himself almost accidentally with a shotgun. And Sailor's back in prison after he finds out that Lula is pregnant, and she waits 6 years to be with her love. And it's pretty funny, and it's sort of oddly similar to the plot and the ending of Beale Street, which I talked about in my last episode, and anyone who's seen both these movies know how unsimilar they actually are. But I actually really love the ending of this movie. It's like this disconnected testament to true love, as because Sailor is prepared to leave Lula to be happy without him. Because he wants her to be happy without him because he's a skeezball. But then he's visited by the good witch who visits him after he's caught up in a fight after using a homophobic slur to a group of guys. And, did I forget to mention that there are Wizard of Oz references throughout this movie for some reason? I guess it hasn't come up yet, but it's super fun. But anyway, the good witch convinced him of this love and that he should go back to be with his family. But this is just after he apologizes to the men that he offended. So he ends up running over all these cars that are in this massive traffic jam for some reason out of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. And he meets up with his family and he sings Love Me Tender, the song he swore earlier in the movie that he'd never sing except to his true love. And I gotta say, there are a lot of amazing scenes like this throughout the movie. Some of them having to do surprisingly with speed metal, which both Sailor and Lula adore. And that's just one of like the juxtapositions that he has, because he loves Elvis and he loves speed metal. But it's not like there's actually like a difference in his character. He just like treats them equally, except his dancing is way more energetic to the speed metal. The first of these scenes being when Sailor gets out of prison and he meets up with Lula and they go dancing, and it seems like it's going to be dancing, but then they just go to a speed metal concert. And oh boy, do they dance. And then there's a fight because Sailor notices someone bumps against Lula. And it just becomes this weird masculine view of love and how he's like proving to his girl that he loves her and gonna fight anyone. And then he grabs the mic from the lead singer. And with the band, they go into an Elvis song and he's just singing it. And it's just so funny. There's swoons and everything. And there's some other standouts. Scenes being mainly like the whole performance by Diane Ladd, who plays Lula's overprotective mother, and she's just crazy. There's a scene where she's rubbing lipstick all over her face because she's stressed out about her daughter, and she rubs it in and her just face is completely red for no reason, and then the next scene is just gone. And so, as I was saying earlier, this is made around the same times as Twin Peaks, and a few of the same characters from Twin Peaks show up, but often in small, silly roles. The first one being Grace Zabriskie, who plays Sarah Palmer in Twin Peaks, as the mother of one of the people who is hired by Lula's mom to kill Sailor, but might also be a hired killer. She's just a weirdo, and there's this really weird scene that she's in, like weirder than any of the scenes she was in Twin Peaks. And then there's Sherilyn Fenn, who plays Audrey in Twin Peaks, the beloved Audrey. And she's just credited as Girl in Accident. And that's all she is. Sailor and Lula encounter a car crash, and she is the only survivor. And she keeps wandering around talking about her missing purse and her money and how angry her mom's gonna be, but all her friends are dead. And it seems like it's this gag that's maybe like a commentary on like consumerism or something, that she's so worried about her bag. But it turns out she's just in shock And that isn't like a funny joke about where her priorities are. She's just in shock and is probably not seeing the situation. And then she just dies. Yeah, that's just like her whole scene. And then Cheryl Lee, who plays Laura Palmer, is the good witch that I mentioned earlier. And it's very convincing, I'd say. Jack Nance, who plays Pete, it shows up and he's just a nutbag friend of Bob's. And he just talks about his sled dogs and is really creepy. But besides these characters showing up, it makes sense that this would be around the same time as Twin Peaks, as we sort of see Lynch playing out some of these soap opera leanings that he sort of like brought into Twin Peaks season 3. But it's sort of a bit more committed, a bit more dark and surreal. And it's sort of weird to think about. These are the things that people mainly complained about in season 2 for being too sort of lighthearted. These like pretty obvious dramatic storylines. But in here, they seem like natural, almost. Well, not natural, but dark and committed and good. But so overall, this movie is just a ride from start to finish in most aspects. There's some shocking and varying visual styles. It's very colorful. Sometimes even it changes the style from shot to shot. And it's pretty alienating. And speaking of that, there's some almost like Godardian sound design. As there are points when Sailor is singing and there's a crowd reaction. And then just like obviously in like post-production, like the audio just starts like cutting and just like cuts out completely. And it's just unrealistic, and it's clearly just like a part of the film and not in the real life in the film. And it's just really weird, and it's great. And this is probably the most fun Lynch film ever. And I think that any fans of his work who have a sense of humor, at least, should definitely check this out. And this morning, actually, I watched Industry Symphony No. 1, which is a concert film made by David Lynch. It was around the same time as Wild at Heart, which is why I'm bringing it up in the segment. So this is sort of just like a stage show. I believe it was actually shown twice in New York. And it's starring Julie Cruz, who, as most people would, fans at least would know, that she did a lot of music for Twin Peaks, all the ones with the singing mostly, and is in the some of like the Roadhouse music scenes. And I personally love her music, especially the ones that her, David Lynch, and Angela Badalamenti did for her solo album as well as Twin Peaks. But this sort of concert film starts with Laura Dern and Nicolas Cage sort of seeming like their characters from the movie, but then they're just on the phone and Nicolas Cage breaks up with her, which is supposed to be the setup for the show, which ends up being just this dream sequence that Laura Dern concocts inside her head. The full name of the movie being Industrial Symphony No. 1, The Dream of the Brokenhearted, where Laura Dern is Brokenhearted Woman, Nicolas Cage is Heartbreaker, and then Julie Cruz is the dream self of the Heartbroken Woman. So yeah, it's pretty fun. So the main point of the production is Julie Cruz songs playing amongst this wide industrial set. There's a lot of cars, there's scaffolding, there's pipes and steam and whatnot. And then there are these people flying around through the air, including Julie Cruz in a beautiful white dress, looking sort of like an angel. And then she just falls from the sky, and then the devil appears, and it's in this sort of like cheap homemade costume on stilts, but it's still pretty affecting, I'd say. But like, there isn't too much to this. The set piece is interesting and dark, some good visuals throughout. There's also a nice appearance from Michael J. Anderson, who plays the man from another place in Twin Peaks, and he's just there, he's sawing wood. He retells the story of Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern with a clarinetist. But overall, just the whole thing is pretty much just this eerie atmosphere that Lynch is presenting. And I'd say this is a good watch if you're a fan of Lynch and you have 50 minutes to commit to Julie Cruz music and sort of being a little bit creeped out. But it's good. I'd say check it out. I'd probably listen to it again or watch it again, I mean. But anyway, now I'm going to go into a break. And this is that King Gizzard song I mentioned earlier. The B-side, this is Acarine. It was a quick decision for Zach to climb Mount Granowin. His family and friends had warned him, but by that point he was already too far across the room and couldn't hear them too well. They'd made some good points, but he didn't really care too much. Didn't care enough to stay at least to hear him out. Zach had been mountain climbing his whole life. He had scaled the wall at his local gym in record time at the age of 4, well, the record time for someone under 6 years old, but still, it was impressive. After winning a state climbing championship in high school, some of his skill may have gone through his head. Zach had been caught on multiple occasions attempting to climb up the side of his house, the local clock tower, and even the local prison, somehow finding himself in a cell. Zach had claimed that he was simply sleep climbing, which would omit him from any consequences under the town's very lenient sleeping bylaws. After graduation, Zach decided that Gronowin would be his next challenge before he went to Harvard on a full-ride climbing scholarship. It would be his last hurrah before he had to follow by the constraints of the formal climbing world. The tales of Mount Gronowin were part of what made it so attractive to Zach. Many have attempted to climb the mountain, yet none had succeeded without the help of either a jetpack or homemade bounce shoes, which are strictly banned by the North American Climbing Association as well as the FDA. There's somebody who claimed that they actually reached the top of the mountain, but once they turned around, they saw that the peak was only rising. There was a new peak that they hadn't seen. This kept happening over and over until they just couldn't take it anymore. Although witnesses claimed that they'd only climbed for 15 minutes and then accidentally rolled down. But we also figured that they had attempted to climb the mountain just after breaking out of the insane asylum, which is conveniently located at the base of the hospital, so these claims make sense. But to be honest, most of the failed examples of climbing Mount Gronowin have been from escapees from this hospital, or as they call them, graduates. But besides that, there had been many attempts over the years. It was said that in the late 1800s, an explorer named Jeremiah Watkins saw a bright light emitting from the top of the mountain, just beneath the clouds. This was a rough time for Watkins and his family. His youngest son Ezekiel had caught scurvy just a week earlier, and they could not afford any medication, or even oranges, or frankly, anything Canadian vitamin C to cure him. On top of this, after some risky bids on some high-stake bridge games, Jeremiah's debt to the local mob was rising, and they were beginning to become eager to receive their overdue interest. Jeremiah saw the bright light from Mount Gronowin and knew that this would be the resolution to all of his issues. He didn't know what it would be, but he knew that someone would pay for it. The next day, as Jeremiah prepped for his expedition, one of the mob bookies came to Watkins' door, just as a reminder. Jeremiah told him that he was certain that he would have the money by the end of the week. The mob wasn't convinced and needed a reason to trust him, in which Jeremiah pointed to the summit and assured his ability to climb it. Jeremiah set out shortly after, in the middle of the night, so his family wouldn't know that he had left. He knew that they wouldn't support him risking his life for the family. Jeremiah only had brief climbing experience, spending one summer out with his uncle in Chile, but that was years ago. Jeremiah pulled out his old gear and set out with a container full of gruel and some dirty water. The mountain didn't seem too hard. Chile was much more challenging, but it was only a few hours later when he finally met the first substantial slope. It was then when Jeremiah heard a loud bang behind him. He looked behind and he saw the mob man from earlier with a gun pointed right at him. He had followed Jeremiah with a plan to steal his luminous treasure. As the mob man began to reload, Jeremiah felt that the only way to escape was to keep climbing. With his adrenaline at an all-time high, he scaled the slope with inhuman speed. When he got to the top, he could see the peak, still ways and ways ahead, but the glow was gone. Could it have all been in his head? He was sure that he had seen it. He'd even pointed it out to his current enemy. He heard another gunshot whiz by him, and then there was a flash that took over the skies, blinding Jeremiah. When his vision returned to him, the mob man was gone. His clothes and his mob-style cowboy hat rested on the ground where he stood, next to them, a pile of gold bars. Jeremiah didn't know much about monetary valuations, but it seemed to be the approximate value of an ominous glowing sphere at the top of a mountain. Jeremiah grabbed the gold and hat and headed back home. He waited for the mob to come to him and claim their interest, which Jeremiah could pay with bars to spare, but they never showed up. It was the next day when Jeremiah heard from the local news teller that the mob's official document of debts had gone missing, along with their most important collector, and a very valuable hat. Jeremiah didn't know who or what had blessed him as so, but he knew that something was looking out for him. The next day, he put on this hat and bought a barrel full of oranges for young Ezekiel and a new horse for his dear wife. The following year was the best one they had ever had. They had a new ranch, they took a trip to Disney World or whatever the 1800s equivalent was at the time, and it was said that they lived happily ever after. But then again, these were only stories. They were only myths. Zach was only partially convinced of Mount Gronowin's mythical potential while he read about Jeremiah in the informative booklet on the bus ride to the mountain. He was upset that he didn't think of the strategy of sneaking out in the middle of the night. It would have saved him so much conflict. When he finally arrived, it was nothing like he had expected. It wasn't this rugged and dangerous mountain, exclusive for the rugged and dangerous like himself, but it had become a tourist destination. There were guides, tours, a signature cafe. There was even a gift shop selling novelty mob cowboy hats to commemorate the tale of Jeremiah. Had the mountain sold out? Zach didn't know how he felt about this. As much as he hated the corporate intrusion onto nature, he couldn't let it depart from his journey. As much as Mount Gronowin Corp may have watered down, the mountain was still there, and it was still dangerous. Zach snuck past all the distractions as quickly as possible and got to the base of the mountain. Since he had been planning on free soloing the mountain, there was no prep needed. Free soloing is the art of climbing without any equipment, just as our ancestors did. When Zach climbed like this, he felt a connection to his past, to those who had climbed before him, like he was tapping into the collection of great climbers. He felt the presence of all the greats, like Hingy Jones, Jinko Rasha, and even the late great Pertley M. Hunkins. Zach began his scale at a comfortable and sustainable pace, as he always done. It wasn't even 30 minutes until Zach had heard a whistle and shouts. He turned around, and there was a pack of 4 park rangers behind him. It was then that Zach remembered Jeremiah's tale. Were these his mob men that he needed to escape from? Would the gods of the mountain reward him as they had rewarded Jeremiah? He turned around with all the power he had to scale the mountain as quickly as possible, when one of the rangers said, "Hey kid, the conditions a bit up the mountain are a bit slippery from yesterday's rain, and we can't advise anyone goes up there without proper equipment until further notice." Zach stopped and turned around. "Until further notice?" he asked. The rangers caught up with him and told him that free soloing was fine with the facility and the parks department as long as he passed a test and signed a waiver. The mountain would probably be safe by the end of the week, and the test could be completed by then as well. Zach felt let down, but relieved. He could have died if he went up there without telling anybody. The rangers took Zach back to the mountain and helped him to a coffee and a bagel. They even gave him one of the cowboy hats from the gift shop as he seemed enthusiastic about the old fables. After their meal, Zach booked his tests and took an advised tour up the mountain. It was very lovely, more than he'd ever realized. Zach came to see that his view of this piece of nature hadn't gone further than the danger it represented. Maybe this was a flaw in his character. He didn't really know what it represented. All he knew was that he had to go home and apologize to his mom. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to another episode of Owen's Variety Hour/Show. I hope you had a good time. And as always, ignorance of your culture is not considered cool. Have a good night. Here is Jenny Haval with Spells.